President Trump says it is a question of when, not if, he sends the National Guard and a surge of federal law enforcement agents into Chicago.
That has Chicago on edge and city leaders figuring out how to best prepare and respond.
For Friday, September 5th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Juana Summers. Florida leaders are vowing to end vaccine mandates.
We will hear what doctors are telling their patients.
It's like saying that I'm going to drive drunk and it's my car, my body, but that endangers everyone else on the road. There has to be rules in place.
And millions of Americans struggle with high blood pressure.
The latest on new ways to prevent or treat the deadly problem.
In hypertension, we haven't seen anything new since the 90s that was effective.
Plus, we'll head to Los Angeles, where the goth scene is making a comeback. First, the summary of the day's news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Janine Herbst. President Trump today signed an executive order rebranding the Department of Defense the Department of War. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth and Trump both say this reflects a new tone for the country and the military.
We won the First World War. We won the Second World War. We won everything before that and in between. And then we decided to go woke and we changed the name to Department of Defense. So we're going Department of War.
But while Congress created the Department of War in 1789, President Truman signed the law creating the Department of Defense from what remained of the War Department in 1949, after World War II. The new name will actually be the department's secondary title. Trump suggested the administration would ask Congress to codify the change into law, but also said, quote, "I'm not sure they have to." Police arrested two teens in connection with a high-profile shooting death of a congressional intern in Washington, D.C. As Alex Coma of member station WAMU reports, they're being charged with first-degree murder.
The killing of 21-year-old Eric Tarpinium Jackham is one of several prominent crimes that have become a rallying cry for President Trump as he sought to control D.C.'s affairs. Prosecutors believe two 17-year-olds were targeting another man in a drive-by shooting when they inadvertently killed the intern instead. U.S. Attorney for D.C. Jeanine Pirro is charging both teens as adults as part of her broader attacks on the city's juvenile justice system.
This killing underscores why we need the authority to prosecute these younger kids, because they're not kids, they're criminals. They're violent criminals.
Investigators are still searching for a third suspect. For NPR News, I'm Alex Coma in Washington, D.C.
Hiring in the United States slowed significantly in August. The Labor Department says employers added 22,000 jobs during the month. That's far fewer than were expected. And NPR Scott Horsley says the nation's jobless rate ticked higher to 4.3%.
For the second month in a row, the report shows U.S. employers added far fewer jobs than forecasters had expected. Factories and construction companies cut jobs last month, as did the federal government. Healthcare was one of the few industries to add jobs, and even there, hiring was slower than in previous months. Revised figures show a net loss of jobs in June for the first time since the depths of the pandemic in late 2020. The Federal Reserve has been keeping a close eye on the softening job market as it weighs a possible interest rate cut later this month. Investors widely expect the central bank to lower its benchmark rate by a quarter percentage point. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
And the Fed's next policy meeting kicks off on September 16th. Wall Street lower by the closing bell, the Dow down 220 points. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Four Democratic senators are urging the Smithsonian to resist White House attempts to, quote, bully the institution to go against its mission and values. These remarks come in a letter sent to the institution's secretary today. As NPR's Anastasia Siloukas reports, three of the authors have ties to the Smithsonian.
The letter was sent to the Smithsonian Secretary, Lonnie Bunch, from Senator Alex Padilla of California. Its co-authors are Senator Catherine Cortez Masto of Nevada and Senator Gary Peters of Michigan, who are both on the Smithsonian's Board of Regents, as well as Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon, who is the ranking member on the subcommittee overseeing the Smithsonian's federal funding. The senators assert that Smithsonian oversight rests with Congress, not the White House. They also tell NPR they're working to keep its federal funds flowing. The move comes weeks after President Trump called the Smithsonian and other museums, quote, the last remaining segment of woke. Anastasia Silkas, NPR News, New York.
Artificial intelligence company Anthropic will pay a landmark $1.5 billion to settle a class action suit from authors and publishers. It allows Anthropic to avoid going to trial over copyright claims for downloading millions of books without permission and storing digital copies of them to train the company's chatbot called Claude. Under the agreement, Anthropic will pay around $3,000 a book, and about 500,000 books are eligible for that money. Anthropic did not admit wrongdoing. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include EBSCO, committed to providing perpetual access to print and digital books for libraries and the communities they serve. Learn more at EBSCO.com. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
It is 4:06, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. And now a message paid for by the Minnesota Department of Health. Sometimes you just need to talk about it, but it can be hard to find someone who really listens. That's why there is 988, with support that meets you where you are. Confidential and staffed by trained folks who want to help people when they need someone to talk to. Call or text 988 or chat online at 988lifeline.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Scott Detrow. All this week, Chicago residents have been on edge, bracing for the Trump administration to deploy the National Guard and escalate immigration enforcement in the city. Although President Trump has been broadly critical of crime in Chicago, so far federal efforts in the city have focused on immigration. Adriana Cardona-Magiga of member station WBEZ in Chicago has been reporting on what is happening there and joins us. Hi, Adriana.
Hello, Scott.
President Trump has been clear about what he wants to do, right? Increase immigration enforcement and deportations. What have you seen so far this week in Chicago?
Yeah, well, city officials say they've learned there could be some couple hundred federal agents arriving sometime soon at a naval base in North Suburban Chicago, but we don't know exactly how many have arrived yet. My colleague spoke with officials who asked to remain anonymous because they did not have permission to speak on the record. And said the agents who are there have been practicing crowd control tactics and shields and flashbang grenades. This enforcement is expected to last at least 6 weeks. As it stands, though, we haven't seen any presence of the National Guard.
No National Guard presence yet, but again, hearing from city officials that agents could already be amassing. And all of this is happening. You know, this month is during National Hispanic Heritage Month. It's a month where there are a lot of Mexican independence festivities in Chicago. I'm curious how people are feeling about the celebrations.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of mixed feelings. Some people are fearful and others aren't, mainly because they're citizens. There are several parades, three major ones scheduled this month. The first tomorrow in a neighborhood called Pilsen. It's a mostly Mexican immigrant community. Some elected officials and community leaders are asking residents not to let fear stop them from honoring their culture. And today they held a press conference in Little Village, another mainly Mexican immigrant community, to announce that a larger Mexican parade scheduled for next weekend won't be canceled. Here is Jennifer Aguilar. She's with the Little Village Chamber of Commerce.
For more than five decades, this parade has shown the pride, the strength, and the resilience of our bar community. This year's theme, Pride and Power, Our Strength, Our Legacy, reminds us that we are job creators, innovators, and community builders.
Yeah, so Aguilar goes on to say that they are not, you know, they're doing what they can to ensure the safety of participants. However, another two-day festival, El Grito, also scheduled for next weekend, was postponed. Organizers of that event said state and city officials recommended that because of the possibility of immigration arrest.
It sounds like there's a lot of uncertainty. How are people handling it?
The immigrants who are most vulnerable because of their status are afraid to go to work. They send their kids to school or, you know, go grocery shopping. And the tension is real for many people who are kind of like just making a decision, like, do I stop working for more than a month or do I not send my kids to school? Meanwhile, residents who are U.S. citizens have been organizing on the ground to help immigrants. I'm saying food distribution drives, carpooling initiatives. Mm-hmm. There are community rapid response groups on high alert. Mm-hmm. And people are volunteering their time to patrol the neighborhood, take video, and sound the alarm if, you know, just to stop federal agents wanting to make arrests in their communities.
Yeah.
Some of those volunteers are prepared to step in if they see anyone being assaulted. And a lot of trainings are going on, like Know Your Rights trainings and know what to do if you spot any immigration mm-hmm. arrests by that, federal agents.
That is Adriana Cardona-Magiga, who covers immigration for WBEZ. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
More than half of Americans aged 40 and over have high blood pressure. There are typically no symptoms, but left untreated, it can be deadly. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports on new recommendations aimed at prevention and a new experimental drug that experts say has some promising results.
When George Solomon was told about the risks of high blood pressure, he was hesitant to take medications because he felt completely fine. Then at age 63, he had a stroke.
I've been active all day outside. I've been to the gym. And then at 7:30 that night, I went upstairs to watch a movie. When I sat down in the chair, I couldn't get back up. I had a sensation that came up across my back.
He lost feeling in his arm and his leg and was rushed to the hospital. After months of recovery, he regained much of his strength and he's taking medications.
I am feeling healthier. I think that in combination of the lifestyle and weight reduction, more cardio, still doing the strength training, yes, it makes a big difference.
New guidelines from the American Heart Association focus on early prevention. Dr. Dan Jones, who chaired the committee that wrote the guidelines, says it can be beneficial to start blood pressure medications as soon as blood pressure hits the risky range.
For all people with a blood pressure over 140, over 90 millimeters of mercury, we recommend beginning with two medications.
The new guidelines also emphasize lifestyle strategies, including a low-sodium diet, exercise, and stress reduction in the form of meditation, yoga, or deep breathing. For people with systolic blood pressure, that's the upper number in the 130s, the recommendation is to start with these changes, then move to medication if it does not improve. Dr. Jordy Cohen is a nephrologist and a hypertension specialist at the University of Pennsylvania. She says millions of adults in the U.S. could benefit from medications and lifestyle changes.
There's a really enormous preventive health opportunity in treating hypertension earlier. If you catch it early, you treat it early, you really can end up with many more years of healthy life expectancy where you don't have a stroke, where you don't have a heart attack or heart failure because you've treated this earlier.
Some people don't get enough reduction with current medications, so Jordy Cohen says there's a lot of interest in a new class of medication that works by targeting the hormone aldosterone, which helps regulate fluid and sodium in the body. Too much of the hormone is one cause of high blood pressure. She points to new data.
The new study that was released in the New England Journal of Medicine shows that this new class of medications very, very effectively lower blood pressure when used in people who have difficult to control hypertension.
It's one of several studies of the drug baxdrostat, which is not yet on the market. Drug makers plan to share data with regulators by the end of the year.
In hypertension, we haven't seen anything new since the 90s that was effective.
So she says new treatment options would be very helpful. Dr. Jennifer Brown, a cardiologist at Brigham and Women's Hospital, is one of the researchers behind the new study, which was sponsored by the drug maker AstraZeneca and included about 800 people who were taking 2 to 3 medications but still had high blood pressure.
What we saw is that after 12 weeks of treatment, there was about a 10-point improvement in blood pressure in the patients treated with baxdrostat over the placebo effect.
A 10-point drop is linked to about a 20% reduction in the risk of heart attacks and strokes, and also a decreased risk of dementia. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Goth subculture originated in Britain more than 40 years ago, and it is undergoing something of a resurgence. NPR's Vanessa Romo takes us to Los Angeles, where a regular party blends goth with a much more traditional genre.
The scene outside of the Regent in downtown LA on a recent Saturday night is wild. The venue, which holds 1,000 people, is sold out, and the gaggle of goths waiting to get inside is getting antsy, swaying to the Joy Division bleeding through the doors. Tina Estrella, who's known in these circles as Han Tina, made a 50-mile trek to be here.
I commute an hour over here, but yes.
Where do you live?
So I'm like an hour east, yeah.
It's Gothic Cumbia Night, a mostly monthly dance party combining goth and cumbia music. Cumbia is a genre of Latin American dance music that first became popular in the 60s. It combines guitars, synthesizers, and African-based percussion, and it's most recognizable for its kind of rhythm. The night is a chance for LA's Latino goths, or darks, to turn out in their best outfits and sweat the night away. Gothic Cumbia is the witchy brainchild of a Latino American creative collective called Los Goths Company. Its founders keep their identities anonymous. They say they want to maintain a sense of mystery. In a statement, they said their goal is to celebrate their dual identities with, quote, those who find joy in the blend of tradition and darkness. The mashup is clearly resonating with Latino partygoers. Hundreds of first-generation kids who grew up listening to Bauhaus in their bedrooms and Los Angeles Azules at family birthday parties are all flocking to the dance night.
You get that nostalgia of, like, this is the music I grew up on, you know? So it's really fun to have, like, that good balance of, like, the dark wave subculture, but you're also listening to, like, the songs that you would listen to in your dad's car.
It's like the commitment of goth, but with a sense of humor. Goth, pero vaquero, or cowboy. That's Ray Garcia's inspiration. He's become internet famous as Goth Dio. It takes him 3 hours to do his makeup, but his outfits?
I went inside my father's closet, got the leather jacket, got the boots, put the pants and the belts, and try to make it look Western goth. Add my own flavor into the already established vaquero look.
Out on the dance floor, the Los Goths crew have decorated the Stark space with black balloons. The team throws out multicolored light sticks for people to wave around, which they do, gleefully. Up on stage, there are 2 12-foot-tall skeletons, the kind you get at Home Depot around Halloween. There's even a guy on stilts, dressed as a robot, who cumbias his way through the crowds.
I don't know. I've never seen it before. If it has been somewhere, I just haven't been there.
That's Alexia Rodides. They've been trying to make it to Gothic Cumbia for months. As a musician, Rodides loves the collision of their 2 favorite genres. It may seem counterintuitive to others, but if you know, you know, they say. Because in a lot of goth music, and even goth-adjacent stuff, like The Smiths, there's a lot of crossover, according to Rodides.
Because there's a two-step element to it. And, like, the two-step is like a cumbia step, you know what I mean? Because they just, they meld together in, like, such a beautiful way.
It's definitely a vibe, and one that's gaining momentum. Next month, they'll be in Texas, so get your dark tejanas ready. Vanessa Romo, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 18 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. Coming up next is your daily dose of phonology. We receive support from Hibbing Chrysler Center, serving the Northland for over 25 years on the Beltline in Hibbing. Their service center provides regular maintenance and major auto repairs weekdays from 7:30 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. More details online at hemmingchrysler.us. Now it's time for your daily dose of phonology.
On today's date, September 5th, in the year 2000, I noticed that the round-leaf dogwood berries are becoming ripe. These berries sit atop of the round-leaf dogwoods on these red cymes. These are the structures that supported the flowers and are now supporting the berries. You'll notice there are far fewer berries than there were flowers last spring, and that's because the plant has many sterile flowers among that big disc of white flowers that you see every spring. But now, in the fall, you're seeing berries that are kind of a skim milk blue and can get even more intensely blue to almost what I would call sky blue. The berries become quite lovely atop those red structures. And as you're looking at those berries, look at the leaves of the plant and notice how they are starting to turn burgundy. And when all is said and done, if the bears haven't eaten these berries, which are among their favorite fall foods, there will be a beautiful burgundy bush topped with these bluish white berries.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Juana Summers. Florida could soon be the first state to eliminate all vaccine mandates for adults and children. Governor Ron DeSantis and his Surgeon General Joseph Latipo announced that plan earlier this week. Here's Latipo.
Who am I as a government or anyone else, or who am I as a man standing here now to tell you what you should put in your body?
Now, eliminating many vaccine mandates in Florida will require approval by the legislature, and it's unclear whether state lawmakers will support the governor's push. To help us understand what this could mean for people, we have Dr. Mona Amin on the line. She is a pediatrician in Fort Lauderdale. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Amin, I just want to start by asking you, when you heard that announcement from the governor and the Surgeon General, what did you think? What came to mind first?
There was a lot of big feelings that came up. I was actually in the middle of a meeting and I started getting all these messages on my phone. And so hearing this happen, hearing the applause in that conference was very disheartening and demoralizing as a pediatrician who works day in and day out to try to educate families on the importance of vaccines, answering their questions, and trying to really be on the side of public health.
We have heard warnings from scientists as well as public health workers that we could see a resurgence of diseases like measles or whooping cough if these policies go through. How realistic are those concerns?
It's very concerning because we are in a state that already has lower vaccine rates than the national average. And so, for example, in Florida, preschool and kindergarten vaccine coverage has dipped to the high 80s. That's well below the CDC's 95% threshold needed to prevent outbreaks. And so to educate, we were talking about something called herd immunity. And so in order to protect communities for something like measles, 95% of the community has to be vaccinated against measles to reduce the risk of spread. So when those rates are already at the high 80s, and then when we remove vaccine mandates, that could mean an even lower dip into the 70s, 60%. And that can mean an increased risk of measles spread and also other diseases that we've seen long gone now coming back.
Some people argue, as DeSantis and his administration do, that this should come down to personal choice. What do you say to people who make that case?
You know, I respect it in so many different aspects of health, but when it comes to something like public health, it's really important to remember that the decisions we make impact others. And it's like saying that I'm going to drive drunk and it's my car, my body, but that endangers everyone else on the road. There has to be rules in place. So when it comes to infectious diseases, and we're talking about things on that routine childhood schedule, these are things that have been studied for decades, have been given to children for decades, and are effective and have been shown to be effective. We know that these are going to prevent the illnesses from spreading. So in regards to infectious diseases, we are seeing the impact there. If I don't get measles protection, if an entire community stops vaccinating or that rate drops below a certain threshold, we can now cause newborns, immunocompromised individuals, grandparents, those who aren't able to get vaccines due to medical issues now be at risk of getting these viruses and infections when they weren't before.
Most states already allow parents to avoid vaccine mandates for personal or religious reasons. And in the last school year, nearly 5% of Florida kindergartners claimed non-medical exemptions, as I understand. So how could a policy like this one, like what Governor DeSantis has proposed, really affect childhood vaccination numbers in your state of Florida?
So as a pediatrician, you know, I see patients and it's very nice when they have to start school and they come to me and they haven't vaccinated and then now they're starting that process, right? Because of the school mandates, people are having to get vaccinated. So that increases vaccine rates in a community. Now, if this mandate goes into effect, those families will now not have to vaccinate. They won't be coming to my office. They won't be getting the vaccines and they'll be entering school systems. So that number can continue to rise.
Dr. Amin, you work with families every single day. What kinds of conversations have you been having with parents since this decision was announced?
So this happened earlier this week, that this announcement, and I was in clinic this morning, actually. And a lot of my families, thankfully, are very vaccine informed. They have amazing questions. A lot of them ask me, what does this mean? My job is to reassure my families, but at the same time, live in this world where I don't know what the future will hold. And that is hard as a pediatrician, as someone who cares so deeply about my community, about my child's safety, about the safety of all of my patients. And all we can do is advocate and hope that we are going to make a change where this is not going to actually go into effect.
That is pediatrician Dr. Mona Amin. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Rosalind Drexler was a pop artist icon, a novelist, a playwright, a singer, a mother. She simply could not be boxed in, and she did not want to be defined.
I never sat down and said, hey, what are you today? I was always doing what was natural to me and right, same as like sex and fights and making food.
That's Drexler speaking with Art Forum magazine in 2016.
They was all of one piece in a life. It's a continuum of activities that are satisfying.
Drexler died earlier this week. She was 98.
Her life was kind of surreal. Like, she was related to one of the Marx brothers. She sang. She wrote musicals. Danny DeVito was in one of her plays with Judd Hirsch.
That is Sid Sachs, Drexler's close friend and former director of exhibitions at the University of the Arts.
She had great integrity and great intelligence. She had a sense of humor that she was able to use. And also a sense of maybe tragedy also.
As a pop artist, Drexler used movie posters, magazines, and newspapers as canvas to illuminate the world around her through prosaic and gritty imagery. Sachs says the inspiration behind much of her visual art came from enduring the Depression era, growing up in the Bronx, and from her deep love of reading.
Literature, I think, was her mainstay, and she absorbed all the language plays and her intelligence from reading, and then she was able to use that in making her pop art.
She described her bump in with writing in a Smithsonian oral history interview.
All I had was a paragraph or two, and this guy said, I want to publish you. I said, okay. He said, I'll be back in 2 years and get me a book. And I said, okay.
One of her novels, The Cosmopolitan Girl, is about a woman's love affair with a talking dog. Another is an adaptation of Sylvester Stallone's film Rocky. And yet another, called The Smithereens, is about a female wrestler named Rosa.
Which checks out, because among Drexler's accolades was a stint as a professional wrestler. She was prolific in the final years of her life. The Rose Art Museum at Brandeis University held a major retrospective exhibition of Drexler's work in 2016. Her art also lives on at major museum collections like the Museum of Modern Art.
Sid Sachs says he'd been trying to catch up with his old friend in the weeks before her death.
And I, as I'm talking to her, I'm almost crying. I mean, she was really a wonderful person. And some of the artists are not wonderful people. So to be a wonderful person and an artist and a writer and to have touched that many people is marvelous and sublime.
In Drexler's own words, it was a rich life.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 4:29, and you're tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE, People Power Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is National Native News. Support comes from Thrive Up North, sharing the stories of a welcoming community of people who've chosen to make Itasca County their new home, promoting all the area has to offer, including natural amenities and jobs in healthcare, manufacturing, and more, offering an incentive package to help with your move to the area. Learn more at thriveupnorth.com. And we receive support from the Watermark Arts Center in downtown Bemidji, with exhibits, classes, and handcrafted original art made by regional artists found in their shop 505. The center is accessible and open to the public, watermarkartcenter.org. Northern Exposure to Lifelong Learning presents a program on New Zealand travel Wednesday, September 10th at 9:30 at the Begley Public Library. Doors open at 9 o'clock. Now for National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Bureau of Indian Affairs offices in Wisconsin and Minnesota remain open after the Department of Government Efficiency targeted them for termination. As Danielle Kading reports, the initiative formerly led by billionaire Elon Musk had proposed canceling leases for several offices earlier this year.
The cancellations affected offices in Ashland and Shawnee in Wisconsin and Bemidji in Minnesota. Wisconsin tribes say the Bureau of Indian Affairs office in Ashland is a critical regional hub that processes land trust applications and provides education assistance and law enforcement support. Robert Blanchard is chair of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. He says closing the office would have been a hardship for the tribe.
We would have probably had to go maybe Minneapolis or some other place further away from us to get services.
Bill Broidrick represents the owner of the Ashland office. He says Wisconsin tribes adopted a resolution in opposition to its closure.
On that basis, the decision was made by the Bureau of Indian Affairs to keep the office open.
The Bureau of Indian Affairs says all three offices remain open. The agency says it's working to ensure adequate space continues to be available to support delivery of services to tribes. For National Native News, I'm Danielle Kading.
A site on Douglas Island could be the future home of a casino-like gambling hall due to a proposal from the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska. The proposal was approved by the National Indian Gaming Commission. Tlingit and Haida says the facility's approval represents a step toward economic self-sufficiency and sovereignty for the tribe. KTOO's Clarice Larson has more.
The land is on Fish Creek Road, not far from Eaglecrest Ski Area on Douglas Island. It's just a small piece of a native allotment owned by tribal members who lease it to Tlingit and Haida. Tlingit and Haida spokesperson Dixie Hutchinson confirmed that the tribe is developing a gaming facility. The tribe intends to offer Class 2 gaming, which covers things like pull tabs, bingo, and slot-style electronic machines. The National Indian Gaming Commission's acting chair approved the tribe for site-specific gaming at the location in January. The decision came just days before President Donald Trump began his second term in office. For decades, federal officials and state officials in Alaska have said that native allotments owned by tribal members in Alaska were not considered Indian country. Therefore, they are not under the jurisdiction of tribes and cannot be home to casinos or casino-like gaming halls under the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act. But Michelle Jockathot-Demert, a professor at the University of Alaska Fairbanks Tribal Governance Department, says the legal interpretation of native allotments shifted when President Joe Biden came into office.
During the Biden administration, there was a solicitor's opinion that evaluated the laws and made the determination that the laws supported that Indian tribes in Alaska have jurisdiction over allotments.
She says gaming serves as an important governmental function for many tribes in the U.S.
You know, people look at it that it's just this big money-making operation, but it's so much more than that. It's an opportunity to make money and an opportunity to put that right back into your governmental system to provide essential services to your citizens.
Hutchinson says the project is still in the early phases of development. She says the tribe intends to reinvest the gaming hall's revenue into essential tribal programs and services. In Juneau, I'm Clarice Larson.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for over 40 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com. Minutes from downtown Anchorage, the Alaska Native Heritage Center is more than a museum. It's where Alaska Native traditions, languages, and arts come alive. There's always something new at the Alaska Native Heritage Center who support this show. More at alaskanative.net.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from BritBox, committed to helping viewers to see it differently with British TV, with new original series like Code of Silence, about a deaf woman recruited as a lip reader in a high-stakes police investigation, streaming at BritBox.com. And from Your Part-Time Controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. YPTC.com/NPR. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Secretary of State Marco Rubio says the Trump administration is at war with drug cartels, and the deadly strike on a fast boat from Venezuela was just the first shot across the bow. Some Latin American governments are expressing unease. NPR's Michelle Kellerman has spent the past few days traveling with Rubio through the region. And as she reports, Rubio says he found willing partners on his visits to Mexico and Ecuador.
Since he took office, Secretary Rubio has added a dozen drug cartels and gangs to the foreign terrorist organization list.
They are narco-terrorist organizations. These are not stockbrokers. These are not real estate agents who on the side deal a few drugs. These are organized, corporate-structured organizations who specialize in the trafficking of deadly drugs into the United States of America.
While the U.S. has relied on interdictions, Rubio says the cartels can factor in those losses, and the best way to deter the business, he argues, is by blowing up boats. And he used his stops in Mexico and Ecuador to put countries in the region on notice.
For cooperative governments, there's no need, because those governments are going to help us identify them. They're going to help us find these people and blow them up, if that's what it takes. They're going to help us with it.
But the Trump administration is on shaky legal grounds with that strike on a fast boat from Venezuela. And there have been mixed reactions in the region, says Brian Nichols, a former career diplomat who was assistant secretary for the Western Hemisphere under the Biden administration.
And there's concern that this could be the precursor to a wider conflict.
Already, Venezuelan fighter jets have buzzed a Navy destroyer in the Caribbean. Nichols says he hopes Venezuelan leaders won't try to, quote, poke the bear. He predicts, though, that the Trump administration will find this new approach to be costly and unsustainable. The former diplomat does agree with Secretary Rubio on one point, that cartels can price in the loss of any drugs that are confiscated by law enforcement at sea.
But they can also price in, the people who get caught will now get killed. So yeah, the price for being one of those crew members on a go fast boat is going to go up, maybe go up tremendously.
And cartels can absorb that cost too.
So these organizations adjust. And if you're not going after the networks, but only those who are transporting them in a visible way, it's impossible to take down the organization.
Fighting cartels requires intelligence sharing, law enforcement, and the cooperation of governments in the region. Rubio's aides say they made progress on that in Mexico and in Ecuador, where they found President Daniel Noboa to be all in on the fight against drug cartels. Rubio labeled two groups there as narco-terrorists and says he may soon designate more. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
Median U.S. home prices are at a record high, and so is the age of first-time homebuyers, 38 years old. One place trying to tackle this is Utah, where family sizes are bigger than the rest of the nation. As NPR's Jennifer Ledden reports, the state is pushing developers to build starter homes people can afford.
Miranda and Cole Potiker are young, early 20s, and they've talked a lot with friends about their terrible timing in the housing market.
We'd make jokes like, what was I doing in third grade? I should have been buying a house instead of learning, multiplication, just because it's been so difficult.
They married 2 years ago and decided to live in her grandparents' basement in northern Utah to save up for a down payment. But when they started looking around, they were shocked at the sky-high prices and how fast homes sold.
Wake up the next morning, it was just gone. And it was just, the market would just be so aggressive.
So they gave up. People like the Potockers are exactly who Utah Governor Spencer Cox had in mind when he set out an ambitious goal last year, building 35,000 lower-priced starter homes in 5 years.
The American dream of home ownership is slowly but surely slipping away from far too many out of reach of our children and grandchildren.
To entice builders, lawmakers funded low-interest construction loans for both single-family starter homes and starter condos. But developers have been slow to sign on. At a housing summit in May, Governor Cox told mayors that so far just over 5,000 starter homes had been built or begun.
We're on our way, but we desperately need to do more, and we need to move faster.
He's sort of saying we all need to chip in here, but I haven't seen concrete steps that would really move the needle right now.
Andra Gent is a finance professor at the University of Utah and says the state could really make a difference if it changed local zoning.
A lot of municipalities throughout the state have minimum lot sizes of a quarter acre. I mean, that's enormous as a lot size. And again, if developers are stuck with that minimum lot size, they're going to build luxury homes.
Utah's governor has proposed loosening those zoning restrictions, but lawmakers said no. That hasn't stopped one developer north of Salt Lake City from taking up the governor's challenge. Jed Nielsen sits on the porch of a new house as construction trucks go by at his latest project in Plain City, Utah. He heads Nielsen Homes, founded by his dad, but he started as a realtor 26 years ago in college.
And other kids going to college would come buy brand new homes from him because they had a job and they went to college and they could afford a home.
Nielsen says it's terrible that today, even couples who both have a college degree and careers can't afford to buy. Inspired by the governor's goals, he cut a deal with the county to build more houses here on smaller plots that normally would be left open.
We're walking around our JDC Ranch community, and the first 12 homes that you see are the starter homes.
They sit right next to market rate ones, a colorful mix of farmhouse, craftsman, and mountain modern.
We intentionally wanted to show that we could put these starter homes in the entrance of a 1,000 home community because they are beautiful architecture.
And how much are they in this pricey market? Well, one state program to help first-time buyers sets a limit of $450,000.
I mean, 5 years ago, $450,000 was a high-priced home in this area, and now we're calling that a starter home.
Utah's governor wants his starter homes to go for less. Nielsen sells his two-bedroom model for $370,000 and a three-bedroom for just under $400,000. Priority is given to first-time buyers and also teachers, first responders, and active military service members. The homes must be owner-occupied for a decade. One of the first to move in here, our first-time buyers, Miranda and Cole Potocker.
This is our little dining nook, which is massive.
One thing that really attracted us to this house was like the windows.
Big ones that let in lots of light. There's also space to work at home and room to start having children. They say they feel extremely lucky.
This is like a base, not only for like our family, but also be able to help us to set us up for the future in so many ways that like we don't even know can come through.
Nielsen has 260 more starter homes in the pipeline here and hopes his experience will spur more developers to step up.
Yeah, maybe I'll make less money per home, but I get to build more homes and I'm going to fix a societal problem. I mean, a society can't function when there's no room at the bottom for people to get started on their upward mobility.
Fixing that will take a while, he says. And one day, he even hopes to create a home that's affordable, again, on a single income. With senior producer Marisa Pendelosa, I'm Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Plain City, Utah.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You are listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE. My name is Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is North Star Stories. And Grand Rapids River Fest is tomorrow. This year's lineup, Courtney Barnett, Margo Price, Jeremy Albino, and Alan Sparhawk. Tickets and info at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com. The Beltrami County Historical Society in Bemidji hosts a forum called Women Elected to Lead, Voices from Local Government, Saturday, September 6th at 10 a.m. Three women with firsthand experience will explore the challenges, responsibilities, and rewards of local leadership. Show your support for veterans at their third annual Meatloaf Run motorcycle ride tomorrow, hosted by the Combat Veterans Motorcycle Association. The ride travels from Grand Rapids through Itasca and St. Louis counties, ending in Blackberry. The Virginia Area Historical Society's annual Fall Fest is tomorrow in the Lions Club building at Olcott Park, starting at 4 p.m. with grilled burgers and brats. Featured speaker is Mark Sage.
This is North Star Stories, voices from where we live. Today in Minnesota,
communities negatively impacted by the fact that cannabis was once illegal are getting a big boost from the state. Then, a new team is adding a Latin-influenced the national sport in south-central Minnesota. And it looks like Minnesota will end up being the home to two Hockey Halls of Fame. I'm Gracie J. The Minnesota Office of Cannabis Management has awarded CanRenew grants to 11 organizations. The grants fund projects that boost economic development, public health, youth programs, violence prevention, and civil legal aid. About 150 organizations applied, requesting more than $22 million, but the program is only able to invest $1 million in communities hit hardest by past cannabis prohibition and discriminatory law enforcement. The grants do not support cannabis businesses. Instead, they fund programs that make positive impacts. Programs will start within 90 days, and the next CanRenew round opens this winter. In today's main story, Minnesota's first all-Latino amateur baseball squad is creating a cultural force and giving Latino players and fans their own space within Minnesota's century-old town ball tradition. Jose Osoria has the story.
Number three, Brady Kinas.
Minnesota has a long, rich baseball tradition that dates back to the 1800s. With the end of their 2025 season, the Wilmer Indians have become the latest chapter in that story.
I moved here to Minnesota 2016 to play college ball at Ridgewater. My Ridgewater team was mainly Latino guys from Puerto Rico mostly.
That's Gene Carlos Morales. He's the founder of the Wilmer Indians. His experience at Ridgewater College in Hutchinson sparked an idea.
I always got this idea to make a team to join the league. There is no Latino teams on the league.
Mr. Morales believed that an untapped talent pool existed, but that potential players were not pursuing baseball because of the language barrier.
They're afraid of us. They're like, no, I'm not going to go over there because I don't know if they're going to reject me or something, so I don't speak English. That was the main reason that I feel like I got to do this.
Mike Nagel is the treasurer of the Minnesota Baseball Association and the founder of the league the Indians are a part of. He says that the sound, the smell of the food, the atmosphere at the ballpark is uniquely different.
When you play the Wilmer Indians in Wilmer, they bring in food trucks that have Latino foods, and everyone that's been there said it's probably one of the coolest experiences they've ever had.
Mr. Nagel points out that like the teams in the past, the success of the Wilmer Indians has reverberations beyond the baseball diamond.
This is way more than a bunch of guys who want to play baseball. This is a paradigm shift.
Minnesota as a whole has a great legacy of baseball.
Frank White is a baseball historian and author of the book, They Played for the Love of the Game, Untold Stories of Black Baseball in Minnesota.
You talk about town teams. I mean, that is still today, town team baseball is very popular. They have big crowds that still attend some of the games, the state tournament games.
Mr. White feels that the Wilmer Indians are part of a larger tradition of baseball in the area, like the Minneapolis Gophers, who predated the Negro Leagues by several years, and the Negro League teams that toured the area.
Initially, the acceptance of Black players here was well received because of the popularity of people going to watch them play. I mean, they were a gate attraction.
Mr. Morales, the Wilmer Indians founder, says he received some pushback about the team's name, leading him to seek approval from some of the local Native American communities. He believes that the name reflects the ancestry of the team's players.
Get some negative feedback, but saying we are Latinos. I mean, I take the name to represent our traits, our ancestors, and everything.
The Indians made it to their league's amateur tournament, where they won one game. Their season ended the first week of August, but the team will be back in action in early September when they participate in their fall classic tournament. For North Star Stories, I'm Jose Osoria.
You are listening to North Star Stories. The U.S. Hockey Hall of Fame won't be moving to the Twin Cities after all. Instead, a group that wants to honor the sport is planning to build a new $70 million State Hockey Hall of Fame in the metro area. The goal is to break ground next year and open the facility in 2028. A development partner, corporate sponsors, and individual donors will fund the new Minnesota Hockey Hall of Fame. The plan calls for a professional-sized hockey rink that could host high school, college, and even professional games. Those creating the new facility say that rather than competing with them, they would like to partner with the U.S. Hockey Hall of Fame in Eveleth.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Federal agents walked into a massive Hyundai and LG Energy Solutions construction site yesterday and detained nearly 500 people on suspected immigration offenses. The site near Savannah, Georgia, is the home of a future electric vehicle battery plant. An Instagram video posted by an account with the name Alex Morales showed a group of people listening to a masked man who identifies himself as part of Homeland Security.
We need construction to cease immediately. We need all work to end on the site right now.
Homeland Security investigation says this was the largest single-site operation they have ever carried out. NPR's Camila Domonoski covers cars for NPR and joins us now. Hey there.
Hi.
What do we know about this workplace raid so far?
Yeah. So Homeland Security Investigations, which is the branch of ICE that carries out this kind of workplace raid, they say that they detained 475 people, most of them South Korean. Hyundai and LG Energy Solutions, both of those companies are headquartered in South Korea. Here's Special Agent Stephen Schrank speaking at a press conference.
Some that illegally crossed the border into the United States, some that came in through visa waiver and were prohibited from working, some that had visas and overstayed their visas.
So who was employing the people who were detained?
It's a good question. You know, in a project like this, there are really complicated webs of subcontractors and subcontractors to subcontractors. Hyundai says that it believes that nobody detained was directly employed by Hyundai Motor Company. LG Energy Solutions hasn't responded to NPR's requests for comment. That Homeland Security official said that this raid was tied to, quote, allegations of unlawful employment practices and serious federal crimes, end quote. He did not provide more details on that, and there are no charges filed in this case right now. Officials say this is an ongoing investigation. It would be unusual if charges are eventually filed, because immigration raids like this, where workers are detained, they don't often end with criminal charges for employers.
Tell us more about where this raid happened.
It's on this huge campus of buildings near Savannah, Georgia, that also includes a large factory where Hyundai is right now building electric vehicles. That factory was not directly affected by the raid. Production of vehicles didn't actually stop. But the battery plant that's under construction nearby, which is where the raid actually happened, it's an important part of the long-term plans for this facility, because the goal is to build not just electric vehicles, but the whole supply chain for these vehicles here in the U.S. And that's important not just to Hyundai, but actually to the United States more broadly in this effort to try to compete with China over the future of electric vehicles. Mm-hmm. So Hyundai is investing some $26 billion in moving manufacturing to the U.S., including this project. It's a big deal for the company and for Georgia. The state's called it the largest economic development project in state history.
What's the response from local and South Korean officials been to this raid?
In a statement, Governor Brian Kemp's office said, quote, in Georgia, we will always enforce the law. Congressman Buddy Carter, who represents the area surrounding the plant, he posted on X that he applauded the Trump administration for taking bold action. Both those Republicans have been vocal supporters of the big complex being built here. Mm-hmm. I was at the grand opening earlier this year. They both spoke. Obviously, a big part of their support was always about local jobs. Meanwhile, the South Korean Ministry of Public Affairs says it has voiced concerns to the United States about respecting South Korean economic activity and citizens.
That is NPR's Camila Domonoski. Thank you so much. Sam Greenglass of member station WBAE contributed to that report as well.
This year marks the 20th anniversary of the first Twilight book. The fictional story of vampires, werewolves, and teenage love is set in the real town of Forks, Washington. It was once the self-proclaimed logging capital of the world, but that industry has waned. And now there's a booming Twilight economy. Matt Martin from member station KUOW took a drive out there.
At a small pull-off next to Scenic Highway 101, Jay Marizon holds up his smartphone to snap a photo of his niece, Twilight fan Katie Baker.
Got it.
Yes!
The pair is standing in front of a large green sign that says, "The City of Forks welcomes you." Baker is visiting from Florida and has loved Twilight since her sister gifted her the first book.
I just love the story behind it and, like, just how they're together forever, because I guess I'm just, like, a hopeless romantic.
In case you're not familiar, the Twilight series is about a teenager who falls in love with an ancient vampire and, spoiler, becomes one herself so she can eternally be with him.
My childhood, I was coming up on Twilight, so it would be a sin if I didn't come here and check it out.
Baker is one of many people who come to Forks each year because of the Twilight books and movies. It's not the only reason. The town is on the Olympic Peninsula, which is full of beautiful beaches, parks, and forests. Still, there's been a huge uptick in visitors since Twilight. The year after the first movie was released, the number of people who stopped by the visitor center in town jumped by about 50,000. And Forks has embraced the attention. As you drive into town, you might tune into a local radio station.
Twilight 96.7.
Twilight 96.7. Or pop into a local cafe.
Hi. Can I get the Twilight tea?
But it wasn't always this way. Forks was a logging town.
In the 1960s and 70s, which was kind of the peak of the logging activity in this area, this was a very wealthy town.
Tom Roseman's family owned a sawmill here that shut down in 1989. He says increased regulations, over-harvesting, and more milling overseas led to the decline of the industry here.
We had meetings in this town asking, what's the future of Forks? It was no longer the wealthy town that it had been.
They were starting to, like, board up the windows on businesses downtown. It was dismal.
Lissy Andrus is a Twilight superfan who moved to Forks from Texas because of the books. She now heads the local Twilight Museum and the Chamber of Commerce.
And when the Twilight book was published and then the movie was announced, it just breathed life into the area.
In 2023, food, retail, and accommodations made up 32% of the economy in Forks. 2 decades before, it was 16%. There is one big complaint from some locals. Twilight author Stephanie Meyer based her werewolves on lore from the neighboring Quileute tribe. The website Truth vs. Twilight is a collaboration between the Quileute tribe and the Burke Museum of Natural History and Culture. It says Meyer misrepresented their culture, and that the Quileute people are portrayed as mythic characters in a fantasy role, rather than as human beings. The tribe declined a request for an interview, and Stephanie Meyer did not respond to a request for comment. But tourists keep coming. 2024 saw a record-breaking year. Tom Rosemond is still surprised at this continued love for Twilight.
Many people, including myself, says, well, this is popular culture. You know, it'll last for a couple of years, 2 or 3 years, and something else will come along, and it'll be forgotten. It hasn't.
It seems just like vampires, Twilight may live forever. For NPR News, I'm Matt Martin in Forks.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Visit St. Pete Clearwater, Florida, where white sand beaches meet the arts, from the Dalí Museum to more than 500 public murals. More at visitspc.com. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at Progressive.com/careers. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at Skoll.org.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. We receive support from Bemidji Brewing, announcing the release of the new Full Stinger Variety Pack, featuring the Blood Orange IPA and Lemon Drop Blonde. Available in liquor stores now. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. The Clearwater County History Center in Shevlin invites you to an open house for National Grandparents Day, Sunday, September 7th, from 1 to 4. Enjoy a car show, wagon rides, and refreshments. You can even make your own ice cream. Weather tonight, mostly cloudy, lows 37 to 42 degrees, northwest winds 5 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow, Grand Rapids Riverfest Day, partly sunny, highs 57 to 60, northwest winds 5 to 10 miles per hour with evening lows 36 to 40.